And we're coming up to 21 minutes after 12 o'clock. Well, nuclear energy is often promoted as clean energy, but how accurate is that description? Nuclear energy creates radioactive waste, so hazardous it has to be regulated by government agencies and isolated for centuries in order to protect human health and the environment. Canada hasn't built a nuclear reactor since 1993, but now, despite not having solved the waste problem, a new generation of small modular nuclear reactors, known as SMRs, are getting a lot of buzz and a lot of government money. The federal government put up $970 million in financing for the creation of the first commercial grid-scale SMR in the G7. Ontario Power Generation has officially broken ground on that project in Darlington, Ontario. Its SMR is expected to come online sometime before the end of this decade. Here in the Maritimes, New Brunswick has already committed $30 million to private companies working to develop new SMRs in that province. This includes ARC, the corporation planning to build its first SMR at Point Lepreau by 2030. ARC is discussing 8 to 12 more SMRs to eventually replace the coal generators at Beldune. Moltex Energy is proposing a reactor to recycle nuclear waste already generated at Point Lepreau. It says it plans to apply to a new $29.6 million fund the federal government just announced earlier this week. All of the SMRs being constructed in Canada are still years away from being operational. There is currently only one operating SMR power plant in the world, and it's sitting on a barge off the coast of Russia. Our question today is, what do you think the role of nuclear power should be in our energy future? How do you feel about a new generation of nuclear reactors being built in Canada? Do you think we can call nuclear energy clean or green energy? The number to call, as always, is 1-800-565-1940. Our email, marnoon@cbc.ca, and we're reachable on social media. Just look for CBC Maritime Noon. We have two guests with us today to shed a little light on SMRs. Susan O'Donnell is the principal investigator of the Rural Action and Environment Research Project at the University of New Brunswick. And Susan is in our Fredericton studio. Welcome to the show, Susan.
Hi, Bob. Thanks for having me.
And we're also joined from Kingston, Ontario, by Warren Mabey. Warren is the director of Queen's University's Institute for Energy and Environmental Policy. Warren, welcome to you as well.
Thanks for having me on.
Can you explain, Warren, first of all, just what these small reactors are and how they're different from traditional reactors?
Yeah, I guess the easiest way to define them is to look at the name. So they're meant to be modular reactors, meaning that they can be built, you know, in a factory setting, and they can be built in a way that can reduce costs. And they're meant to be smaller. Now, small is a relative term. A lot of the SMRs that are being talked about are in the hundreds of megawatt range. The one at Darlington that is going to be built is a 300 megawatt facility, but they are a little smaller than the old conventional plants, with the hope that, you know, the cost will be lower on a per kilowatt basis.
And so when they say grid scale, then that means that they could eventually be hooked up to the local power grid?
Yeah, I think that when they say grid scale, they are really talking about matching local needs. And for a site like Darlington, which feeds into the GTA, the Toronto area, a 300 megawatt facility is probably the appropriate scale. Usually people think a little bit smaller when they're thinking small power plants, but 300 megawatts is what they're looking at there.
Okay, and Susan, proponents are arguing that we need this nuclear energy to get off carbon in time. Do you expect we would see these come online in time to meet that deadline?
That's a great question, Bob. As a researcher, I look at the research, and from everything I've read and the experts that I've spoken with in Canada, the US, and the UK, there's no way that these SMR companies are going to meet their stated deadlines that's outlined in their promotional material. There's no doubt that the reactor at Darlington has the most opportunity or the most chance of eventual commercial success if it actually works at some point in the future. But for example, the two models or the two designs that we have for New Brunswick are so different from anything that's ever operated successfully commercially before that the experts are saying they're going to have difficulty reaching some kind of commercial power generation by 2050, let alone 2030, when we really need them to come online.
And you appeared recently, Susan, in front of the New Brunswick Legislature Standing Committee on Climate Change and Environmental Stewardship back in February. You were representing the Coalition for Responsible Energy Development in New Brunswick at those hearings. What were you trying to convey to the government?
I was trying to convince them, the MLAs on the committee and everyone who was watching, to look at the science and to look at the research. What we have coming out of the government and our NB Power, which is our utility, our electric utility in New Brunswick, is sales and promotional material. That's all we're getting. I mean, if you go onto the websites, all you'll get is wonderful things about them. There's nothing about the economic risks that we're being exposed to as New Brunswickers, the environmental risks and a range of other risks. And so what I was attempting to do was to introduce them to the science and research. I would like to add that we have looked for and found no evidence, for example, that either of these two reactors proposed for New Brunswick have undergone any kind of successful scientific review before they were funded.
Okay, so those are those two reactors. But as I mentioned, you know, there are others that are being considered for other parts of the province as well. So can you give us, I guess, maybe a complete picture, you know, of what's been discussed to date as far as what role and the placement of nuclear reactors would be in New Brunswick?
Sure. Well, there's only the two models. One is by a company called Moltex. Both of these are startup companies that were outside of Canada, came to St. John enticed by NB Power in 2018 to come and apply for funding, basically federal funding. So one of them is a molten salt reactor. It's certainly being planned to be sited at the Pointe-Lepreau nuclear site. The other one is a sodium-cooled reactor, cooled with liquid sodium metal. These are just designs, right? They've never operated, these kinds of reactors have never operated successfully commercially before. Again, that one is being planned for Pointe-Lepreau. I've heard NB Power talk about possibly building four of the ARC reactors at the Pointe-Lepreau site. And now they're talking about possibly building them up in the site up in Beldune, where we currently have a coal fire electricity plant that's also owned by NB Power. And the hope is that eventually some of these reactors could be operational there. However, we only have the two designs currently under consideration in New Brunswick.
Okay. And when you consider those designs, as little as we know, I guess, about them, Warren, and you look over the decades of discussion when it comes to the use of nuclear reactors, period, in Canada, one of the major concerns that people point to is, what do we do with the waste? So have we made any progress on what to do with the hazardous radioactive waste that comes from reactors?
So at a commercial scale, to kind of build on the previous comments, no, we haven't really. There are promising technologies that might be able to use some of that waste as fuel. So, you know, some of the new technologies may be able to use some of that waste as fuel, but we haven't seen that demonstrated at a commercial scale. And, you know, one of the great challenges with nuclear power is that it's a lot like the old supercomputers that they used to build that would fill whole rooms. You didn't get a new generation every year. You were lucky to get a new generation of reactor every decade or two, and that's what we're seeing. You know, it takes decades to get these things designed, built, and tested. And at the same time, we're facing these very, very fast timelines in terms of carbon reduction.
And what are we currently doing with the waste?
The waste right now is primarily, the high-level waste is being collected on site. So it's being kept at the facilities within those kind of berm communities that the facilities are built in and monitored there. There has been talk about deep storage in Ontario, so under the shores of Lake Huron. That may or may not come to pass, but right now they're just being kept on site primarily.
So, Susan, the companies developing these SMRs are saying, look, we are coming up with models that will end up creating less waste, but there seems to be quite a bit of difference of opinion there as opposed to, you know, as far as how much waste actually is going to be produced. There's a Canadian peer-reviewed study from last summer that found that the volume of waste from these SMRs would be between double and 30-fold that of a typical reactor. So what do you know? What's your understanding of the literature?
Okay, well, to be fair, that study, which was, you know, peer-reviewed and is, I'm sure, accurate, there's difference between the high-level, intermediate-level, and low-level waste. And part of what that study was talking about was the amount of intermediate and low-level waste that would be created. But one of the interesting things, and the previous speaker mentioned this, is that one of the companies in New Brunswick, Moltex, is claiming that its reactor can actually fission or burn up, if you want to say that, the existing waste from that's been already made by the CANDU reactor at Point Lepreau. The issue is, and again, this is where I would go back to the science, because all of the science says that that's not going to happen. And in fact, there's only one experiment at a commercial level, but one sustained experiment of actually using that particular technology. It's called pyroprocessing at a lab, the Idaho National Lab in the U.S. And that project has been a financial disaster. It's taken something like 30 times longer than originally planned. It would cost, basically using the data from the Idaho National Lab, it would cost billions of dollars just to reprocess enough waste for one fuel load for the reactor. And so the big question is, why would you use, right now, like the CANDU reactors use natural uranium as fuel, which is one of the cheapest aspects of the whole nuclear fuel process. Why would you take something that's essentially cheap, which is natural uranium, and instead try and extract plutonium from it, which raises all kinds of issues and questions, which is an extremely expensive and time-consuming process to make basically the most expensive kind of fuel that you could possibly make? It just doesn't make any sense.
Okay, well, maybe some of our listeners have questions as well as we go along here this afternoon. We're talking about small modular nuclear reactors and asking, what role should nuclear power have in our energy future? 1-800-565-1940 is the number. And our email is marnoon@cbc.ca. First, before we get to the calls, Cassie Williams has a look at the latest news headlines. Hi, Cassie.
Hi, Bob. The Maritime Lobster Processing Association says it's been unfairly tarnished by a new study on temporary foreign workers in New Brunswick seafood plants. The report highlighted a wide range of issues, including a lack of housing standards and oversight, verbal abuse, and threats of deportation. Also in the news, the PEI Fire Marshal's Office is investigating a fire yesterday that caused significant damage to a mobile home in Summerside. A woman was taken to hospital as a precaution. And the leader of Nova Scotia's opposition, NDP, says that province should follow British Columbia's lead and make contraception medication free. And I'll have more news at 1 o'clock.
All right. Thank you, Cassie. Let's jump to the phones. Anne McAllister on the line from Rothsay in New Brunswick. Hi, Anne.
Hello, Bob.
Hi. So what do you think of nuclear reactors as part of our energy future?
I think they have no place in our energy future, and I don't think they are a legitimate or viable climate solution.
Okay, why?
Well, if you're considering cost and time alone, they fail on those metrics. Advocates, nuclear advocates, count carbon, but they don't count cost and time. And if a project is too slow and too expensive, then the delays plus the added expense have meant that you have lost all that carbon that you could have sequestered with a technology that was faster and more affordable that could have been deployed earlier. And we have mature technologies ready to deploy now in the form of wind, solar, existing hydro, Hydro-Quebec. No one ever talks about geothermal. And of course, I never hear energy efficiency mentioned, which is the cheapest and most effective and fastest way to bring our emissions down.
Mm. Yeah, and so you're seeing the dollar amounts that the federal government and the provincial government, or certainly New Brunswick, are announcing, and you say you're wondering why. Why are we putting so much money into it then, given what you've just said about the timelines here?
Absolutely. Money that is sunk into these nuclear projects that will take well past the time that we need and will be far more expensive, that is money that is lost forever to projects using renewable energy efficiency, storage, and smart grid development that we could be deploying now. And I think that it's a recipe for disaster. I almost feel like our governments, by doing this, are dooming us.
So, Warren, why are we investing so much in nuclear energy?
Well, first off, I think it's just one of the things that are being invested in, and it's partly because governments don't necessarily know what the future energy mix is going to look like. There are big investments being made in renewables, and I am a big fan of renewables and building that side of capacity out. There's a number of questions about, you know, where is our energy demand going? The caller is absolutely right that energy efficiency is going to change those demand curves. And one of the things that we know as we shift, you know, to electric vehicles, for instance, is that the amount of energy that we actually need to move us around goes down. And we're not necessarily replacing joule for joule or unit of energy for unit of energy. But right now, I think the government is investing in a big range of technologies, and that the nuclear piece is just one.
Mm. And, I mean, do you agree with that? I mean, certainly there is money being poured into things like solar and wind power. And to Warren's point, you know, we just don't know what the energy mix will be down the road. So it's you know, I guess instead of putting all your money into one basket, putting into a bunch of baskets.
Well, I think that the nuclear basket is, rather than a basket, is a bottomless pit. It has been plagued by cost overruns, by delays. It has proven itself to be dangerous. There is no solution for the radioactive waste. The reprocessing, which Moltex is proposing, is also linked to increasing and to contributing to increased proliferation risks. And so given all the downsides, why would we go there, and why would we tie up money that could be deployed right now in launching energy efficiency, renewables, demand supply management, pinpoint weather forecasting, existing storage? Why not? These things they exist. They're real. Mm. Why is the government, you know, appearing to focus on something that is so dicey?
Mm. Okay, Anne, thanks for the call.
Thank you, Bob.
All right, we're going to move on to our next caller, and then I'll bring Susan back into the conversation here as well. Robert Tilden is on the line from Sheet Harbor in Nova Scotia. Hi, Robert.
Hi.
Hi, sir.
First caller was great. Her definitions of saving money through efficiency are stunning and ridiculously accurate. The problem is it requires uptake on the part of the public, and the public is a little bit leery of uptake. The other thing is they haven't mandated it and put it into the building code. I mean, there's no reason in a million years to even have a roof with a tar surface on it. It should be a living garden all the time.
Mm-hmm.
But more to the point, radioactive material, great idea. I'd love to see a small modular nuclear plant in the middle of Sheet Harbor. Why? Because it's modular. 2 to 3 transport trucks later, we have power for all of this chunk of the Eastern Shore. Well done. It'll be built in a factory, as one of your guests suggests, which is what it's going to become. Transport trucks are going to be driving along the road with 4 or 5 containers, slapping them together on the ground and hooking onto the grid. They'll be using old radioactive material, which, just for the record and for everybody out there to know, you were to take all the radioactive material in this world that has been used at nuclear power plants, it would fill up 2 hockey rinks. Well, I'm sorry, that's not a lot of waste.
Is it the volume?
Is it power?
Is it the volume that's the issue, though, Robert, or what the actual content of that volume is?
It's a combination of both. Actually, when it comes to radioactive material, mm-hmm. it's almost always encased in something that takes up more volume than the product itself. Okay, so if you have a cup full of radioactive material, you encase it in a 45-gallon drum full of cement.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that stuff can still be used. With the new technology coming forward and the future of that technology expanding, they'll be able to use it not only the second time, but probably the third time, until it'll still be something that's nasty to get rid of. But the sheer volume of it isn't anything to give a damn about.
Okay, so Robert...
You could fill up an old mine somewhere in Nova Scotia, an old gold mine shaft, shove it all down there, cement it into the earth,
okay.
Put a big fence around it with a guard and say, look, don't come in here. But it's not coming out of the ground. It's now buried underground.
All right, well, let's bring
we could use it again.
Okay, let's bring Susan back in. Susan, what do you think? First of all, about the volume of the waste and the ability to be able to use that waste, or, as Robert has just been describing, put it way back down deep into the earth.
Okay, this is really interesting, I have to say. I think everything your caller just said sounds like a wonderful promotional material that would be coming right from the nuclear industry, because they're saying the exact same things. I will talk about the volume of the waste, but first of all, this whole idea about them being modular and built in a factory, this is all part of the promotional game. There have been studies that show that the number of nuclear reactors that are could possibly be required in Canada would not even justify building a factory. So there's, you know, it would take thousands actually to justify building a factory. So that is probably not going to happen.
Well, what is the harm of either building it on site or building it, you know, in a factory? What would be the harm of building it on site?
Well, I don't know. I mean, they don't exist yet. I'm just saying that the industry is claiming that by making them in a factory and making them modular, they're somehow going to be better than the other ones. But there's no evidence to show that this is going to have any effect at all,
mm-hmm.
Or that it can possibly happen, or that the economics are there to make it happen. As far as the volume of the waste, you know, I've heard that hockey rink piece a few times. You know, there's only enough. If the volume of the waste is not a problem, if there's not so much of it, then why is everyone trying to reduce it? Right? It is a problem, and it's going to be a problem for hundreds of thousands of years. Some of that stuff is the most toxic substances known to humanity. It has to be kept isolated from all living things because of the possible consequences of radioactive damage on cells, basically, that can, you know, actually alter genes so that it can be passed on to future generations. So yeah, it has to be kept isolated for hundreds of thousands of years. It can't be shoved down a deep, you know, a deep tunnel and with concrete poured on it. There's no question of that. They are looking at building two of them, or building one of them, at one of two sites in Ontario, as your previous guest said. One's near the Bruce Power Plant, another one in Northern Ontario. It's far, far from being licensed or built or anything like that. In most countries of the world, they've been trying to build one in the U.S. for decades now, and they can't because of local opposition, because nobody wants to live near a high-level nuclear waste dump. That's the problem.
Okay, Robert, thanks for making all of those points, and thanks, Susan, as well, for responding to them. We're going to move along because we do have a number of callers here waiting to get on. Dave Stewart is on the line from Dartmouth. Hi, Dave.
Hi.
Hi. So what do you think? What role does nuclear power have in our future, energy future?
I think there are all sorts of different alternative efficiency, solar power, wind power, that are a lot more economic and a lot safer than what's being proposed. My biggest concern is the terrorism aspect of the nuclear waste, and how do we protect ourselves from that?
Okay.
So that's my thought.
Okay. Does nuclear have any role, do you think, Dave? Or do you think those risks, terrorism risks and maybe some of the other risks, are just too high to even make it part of the mix?
Well, it seems to be a band-aid. We let the horse out of the cart when it came to doing something about climate change. And this seems to be a band-aid towards the aspect of it. The one other issue, of course, is to mean people have to take action to do something. And the one thing about the nuclear option is you can just stick it on the grid and everybody uses their electricity and doesn't have to change their lifestyle. Well, unfortunately, again, we're going to have to change our lifestyle because we're running out of electricity and we have to double the generation capacity in the next 30 years worldwide. And it's, I just don't think with the terrorism aspect that it's worth the risk.
Okay. Thanks for the call, Dave.
You're welcome.
We're going to scoot over to Lunenburg now. Sylvia Winters on the line. Hi, Sylvia. What do you think of nuclear energy as part of our energy future?
Well, to begin, I will say I am ignorant of it, with the exception of if there is a catastrophe somewhere, I hear of it. But my concern is, in the worst case scenarios of what can happen to a nuclear power plant, what are the effects? What's going to be on the news?
Okay. Warren, do you want to handle that one?
Well, that's a good question, and it sort of depends on the power plants, right? So the big disasters that people tend to think of are Chernobyl in Ukraine, which melted down in the 1980s, and which, you know, led to radioactive fallout really all around the world, although it was concentrated in certain parts of Europe and Russia. People also think of Fukushima, which was the nuclear plant that was hit by a tsunami in Japan, and where, again, there was radioactive fallout. And in both cases, you have exclusion zones that have been put in place around the plants. Were a similar thing to happen in Canada, you would see a similar sort of an impact, meaning very likely an exclusion zone around the plant that was impacted, very likely long-term impacts on people, people's health, and on the local environment. There's a difference in the existing CANDU reactors in that the way that fuel is loaded into the facility and the way that it runs reduces the risk of a catastrophic meltdown. Not to say it's not there. It just is a different design, a different kind of a plant. Some of the small modular reactors, again, one of the design, you know, improvements is the way that they're assembled, which again might reduce the risk of a meltdown. But we haven't seen those plants in operation, so it's hard to know for sure.
Okay, Sylvia, does that provide any solace to you, or does it cement your concerns?
It's very general, and I'm aware of what happened in both Japan and Chernobyl. But my question is, suppose we had one here in Lunenburg, and whatever could happen does happen. Do we have how much water contamination, how much health, how much to the all life forms? And I've read a lot about, you know, people going back into Chernobyl and looking. What are we looking at? Our oceans? Most water, except, you know, possibly some of the greatest lakes in the world, water goes to our oceans. The worst case scenario, when you get in your car, you drive every day and you take the risk. But the worst case scenario is always out there. And the results of those worst case scenarios are devastating. And that's what I want to know. What would be the most devastating effects? Forget the fence around the place, the wire fence. But what happens? Nothing stays in one place on this earth.
Okay, thanks for the question, Sylvia, and the call. Susan, I wonder if you're able to answer that question, especially without greater detail of the designs. What do you think?
Well, there's a couple of things. And I think that, you know, Dr. Mabee stated it very well. It's environmental contamination is the main concern. In the Fukushima accident that when three reactors melted down, we had somewhere upwards of 160,000 people who had to be evacuated. And still today, 12 years later, there's about 30,000 people who can't return home and may never return home. And so that is the consequence, is you basically contaminate with radioactive materials a large area. There's particular concerns about one of the reactors in New Brunswick, the ARC reactor that's cooled with liquid sodium metal. And the reason it's never been successfully commercialized is because of the properties of the sodium. It reacts violently with air or water. It explodes or causes fires. There have been numerous fires in these things. And once the when it is decommissioned, you've got this high-level waste that's bonded with the sodium that, again, reacts violently with air or water. So huge potential environmental risks. And we don't know yet how to handle these materials because we haven't gotten there yet. And so basically you're creating a whole new class of environmental wastes that would need to be researched to even figure out how to handle these things. And yeah, and it's right beside the Bay of Fundy, which is one of the most fragile ecosystems, well, rich ecosystems, marine ecosystems in the world. And so, you know, there, a lot of people are wondering about that as well.
All right. Well, let's head to the phone lines in New Brunswick right now. David Thompson is on the line from St. John. Hi, David.
Hi.
Hi. You've been on the show before, and what I recall you saying is that for a while you were opposed to nuclear energy, but in more recent years, you've become more of a proponent. Is that a fair characterization?
Well, no, but there are many David Thompsons.
I tried.
I'm the only one around here. No, I am opposed to it for a whole bunch of reasons. But basically, it's dangerous, uneconomic, unreliable, mm-hmm. and unnecessary. And that pretty well goes full circle around it. For instance, the reactor in New Brunswick, every time we turn around, it's down. And when it shuts down, it doesn't shut down for a few hours like a windmill. It's down for weeks or months or years. I can't remember any time when the nuclear industry people come around and they say, well, you know, we have to do all these things because wind and solar aren't reliable. I can't remember any time that the wind hasn't blown around the Bay of Fundy here for 3 months or the sun hasn't shone for 3 years. Can you?
Well, no, of course not. But so is it basically reliability sort of is getting pushed to the top of the list for you then, I guess, as well as the other concerns that you've mentioned? It may not be there for you when you need it.
It's not at the top of the list, but it seems that with the reactor here, that it's been worse with the downtime since they refurbished it. And the most recent times it's been down, it was down for the most electricity needy months of the year, January and February in 2021. And then it was down this year for a long time, a month and a half in December and January, just mm-hmm. when we don't need it. And the other thing about the darn thing is that N.B. Power people should hang this one on for a while, that N.B. Power is about $5 billion of debt, and the majority of this, probably three-quarters of that $5 billion in money is strictly because of LePro, because of, you know, its failure to produce electricity and all the problems that they've had in it and the cost overruns of building it. Now, someone was on your show a few minutes ago talking about if they made them modular and how you could transport them around in this sort of thing on a few trailer trucks and put them up here and there like a Meccano set. Well, that's just not true. And the ones that they want to build in New Brunswick are not small. They're a third of the size of Le Pro, and I think they're bigger than any of the hydro generation stations in Nova Scotia. And these are not small, but they don't exist, so we can't really examine anything about them because they're just a pipeline line. There was a man called Bricklin who came along here with a drawing of a car in the 1970s he wanted to build, and these guys are just about the same that have come around. I've asked to see plans of the thing or some design work so that we might attempt to analyze the thing, and there is none. Now, climate change.
Yeah, okay. David, we are a little tight on time here, so I'm just going to interrupt you very quickly, but thanks for the call. Appreciate it. And yeah, the Bricklin, part of New Brunswick's colorful history for sure. Warren, there is the one currently operating SMR power plant on that barge off the coast of Russia that I mentioned. Do we know anything about the reliability of it?
Actually, I don't know how reliable in terms of operation it's been. I will say that there's any number of small reactors out there that are military. So we know that the U.S. military, the Russian military, others have built a lot of small reactors to power aircraft carriers or submarines. We know that they are fairly reliable. You know, those ships are out doing what they do. They can operate. I think that Susan's made a great point when she's talked about the fact that, you know, a lot of the new technologies that are being proposed are actually really new. They haven't been used even in a military application. You know, they're brand new. And I think that the caller is right that we haven't seen really small reactors. Most of the small modular reactors that are being talked about are bigger. So you put all of that together, I think that there's a lot to be learned about how these are going to operate.
Mm. Okay, Susan, we just have a minute left. I'm not going to be able to take any more calls, but did you have a final thought before we say goodbye?
I do. I think it's really important to look at the fuel that the reactor's using. Like all the military small reactors use a type of fuel that's called weapons grade, and it can only be used in a military setting. And your previous caller raised the weapons proliferation issues. I think maybe on another show we might want to get into that because there's some serious concerns about the military and weapons proliferation aspects of these projects proposed for New Brunswick.
Okay, we'll leave it there for now. Susan, thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much for the invitation. Really enjoyed it.
And Warren, thanks for you joining us as well.
Thank you for having me.
Warren Mabey is from the Institute for Energy and Environmental Policy at Queen's University, and Susan O'Donnell is with UNB's Rural Action and Environment Research Project.